and would urge people to leave it for the medical establishment to use, because they're the front line combatants in this, and you don't want them to become either infected or dead. So it's sort of common sense. I wish I could tell you taking vitamin B12 would lessen your chances. There's no indication that there's any magic nutrient that's going to improve your risk. Just the common sense, boring one.
QSL. But, you know, what about, like, boosting your immune system? Would boosting your immune system make you stronger, like vitamin B12, C, certain food substances that you could eat, things that make you feel stronger so you maybe can have less of a chance to be infected? Go ahead.
Scheduling question, KC1SM.
Okay, Sam recognized. We'll get to you soon, Sam. If, in fact, the B12 improved or boosted your immune system, then theoretically, yes. The problem is that whenever anyone does any test with these micronutrients, they find that either it's ineffective or so random that they can't draw any conclusions. So, unfortunately, a lot of these products depend upon placebo effects. That if you tell people that this stuff is going to make you more alert, there's a chance that it will make you more alert, no matter what that stuff is. So, unfortunately, as far as medical science is concerned, we have no experimental evidence that any of these things, quote, boost your immune system.
GXM with a comment.
Make sure that you have plenty of good fresh air in your apartment. I mean, I know that this illness partially treated with some kind of respiration that, you know, they have to feed you some kind of pure oxygen or some kind of air to keep the body somehow stronger.
Well, you sort of would think that. Unfortunately, that doesn't really do that. Oxygen can be a noxious agent. You can only expose a little newborn baby to 100% oxygen for a very small time before you fry their corneas. So pure oxygen might sound like it's, you know, four times better than regular, you know, 20%, 21% oxygen, but it ain't. It's a toxic material at that concentration. So there's a lot of things that sound like they might make sense that in practical experience people realize are a terrible idea.
QSL. Thank you, Roy. You know, I tell you, I sleep much better with the window open, even if it's like in the winter time. The air is coming in, I sleep so much better. I feel so much better in the morning. Thank you, KG2RY.
Jackson with a comment.
Okay, Rich, you're second up. Next up is Sam, KC1SAM. You wanted to comment about something?
Sorry. Yeah, I have a question on schedule. Are we sticking to the new schedule, where Paul is going to come on around 10 o'clock, or are we staying on this? I'm just curious. I know whether to come back or not. Casey, when I see him, what would you, Roy?
Yes, Sam, I know that you're a fan of the Space Report. I asked Paul earlier what time he would like to go on, and he told me 10:15. So in 6 minutes, you can turn back the radio and hear his dulcet tones.
Appreciate it. I wasn't here for a while. Okay, I appreciate it very much. Thank you. KC1SAM, standing by.
Zulu?
I didn't quite hear that last signal from someone.
Whiskey 2 Bravo Zulu.
Hey, Rich, before we get to Rich Bravo Zulu, Rich GXM wanted to say something. So first GXM, and then after he's done, I'll get to you, Rich BZ. So WB2 GXM, what would you want to say?
so I'll be very... I'll also be... I'm a Santa Claus, so I'll be very brief. Just watching the news, and they mentioned that if you are one of the 109,000 people that actually do get exposed to COVID-19, you can also be one of the 69,000 people that are in recovery or have fully recovered. The risk of getting it is low, and the chances of recovering from it if you get it are extremely good. And that's all I got to say. AC2GS, WB2GXM.
Okay, Rich, I hope that it comes to be true. There was a very big, scary story a week ago, which I did not share because I kind of suspected it, that a person who had tested positive and then tested negative and then tested positive again, they were presupposing that perhaps you can become reinfected with the virus, which is theoretically possible, but I think in this case, it was more likely just a lab error and a false positive. So again, unfortunately, a lot of facts, not a great deal of information based on facts, but a lot of facts nevertheless. So I hope that that ends up being the ultimate reality, that it was all for nothing. But better to be safe than sorry, as the old saying goes.
KD2GMB.
Yeah, K2GMB. First, let me go back to W2BZ, and then we'll cover you. Okay. So next up is Rich BZ.
Roy, sort of sum it up. When would you predict the next meaningful set of numbers to be released? When I mean meaningful, I mean meaningful. Rather than conjecture, this might happen, this might not happen. Can those numbers be released in the future, and when do you think that would be?
Well, I mean, to a degree, the numbers get released every other minute. You know, when I give these numbers, I tell people at the last time that I looked at them because they're updated minute to minute. I went to a local club meeting. The mortality rate was listed by the World Health Organization at 2.0. When I got there, some guy told me it was 3.4, and I said, I don't know about that. And I went back and looked at the website, and sure enough, they had updated it to 3.4. So this is a very fluid time. We continue to get a lot of information. To make sense of the information, that's another thing entirely. Ultimately, you're going to need to use a lot of 20/20 hindsight to reconstruct what everything ultimately means. But there'll be important numbers day in and day out. I've put links on my roy.ac2gs.com page where you can actually keep account of how many infections, how many deaths, where they're located, which ones are new, which ones are old. All kinds of interesting statistics on the subject. And like I said, they update them, you know, less than hourly. More than hourly, I guess, is the way you'd phrase it.
You're saying there's no set of numbers, two or three numbers, two or three facts where that will settle a lot of fear. If it goes up 3 days in a row, that'll create a lot of fear. There's nothing like that on the horizon at all, is that what you're saying?
Well, again, there's a lot of raw data that you can draw all kinds of conclusions. There's a lovely graph that shows you the time interval and the infection rate. And as the curve keeps getting steeper and steeper, that is not a terribly good sign of what's going on. There's an infectious graph for just cases that are detected, and there's a death chart that shows the known cases of people whose percentage who died. And those keep going up and up, and every so often, places like the World Health Organization will reissue a modified mortality rate, which is incredibly important, and seeing how the disease spreads across the globe is also important. The fact that China hopefully is slowing down in its infectious rate is a good sign. Whether it's a real number or a fake number, I don't know, but it's a number. So, again, there's lots of data all the time. There's nothing, if you want a magic bullet, where if I tell you that wait in 2 weeks at 3:30 in the afternoon, someone's going to tell you whether this is going to be awful or nonsense and a waste of time, it's not going to be like that. People are going to find that reflex point where everyone sort of should know where we're going in hindsight, not in foresight.
The rate of changes, really don't mean all that much in this scenario.
AC2GS. Well, the rate of change changes itself. So you could have it jump up, which it has in the past, and you could have it level out, which it has in the past. And again, 2020 hindsight, looking at the entire curve at the end of it, you know exactly where it peaked. But it's like the stock market. When is it going to bottom out? You know exactly when? Can you give me a date when I would know exactly when it will bottom out? It's sort of, unfortunately, the same problem.
Okay, got it. Thanks, Roy. That's enough.
Okay, I want to get to K2GMB quickly because I don't want to have Sam miss the space report. So K2GMB, you wanted to make the comment?
Yes, Kilo Delta 2, Golf Mike Bravo, and Sam, I'll keep it quick. I work in physical therapy. I work with sick people. I work with sick kids on ventilators. Year in and year out, before, during, and after this virus will have, you know, come to be. And there's a lot of people, you know, freaking out, people I work with, but very few of them have gotten a flu shot. And as has been discussed, a lot more people have died over that throughout the years, you know, and then someone shakes someone's hand, and then they touch the button on the elevator, and then they grab the half and half at Starbucks, you know, and no one was using hand sanitizer. There wasn't a run on hand sanitizer, 2 months ago. So, especially if you're a little bit older, maybe the flu shot would be definitely to your advantage, you know, because while we're worried about this, there's, you know, a few strains of the flu always creeping around. And, you know, there's always that, well, maybe they picked the wrong strain this year. And maybe they didn't. So that's my point, and enough said. Kilo Delta 2, Golf Mike Bravo.
Okay, that's a very good point and gives me an opportunity to repeat myself. I've said this in earlier editions of the Science Talk, for God's sake, people, get a damn flu shot. It would have been nicer if you got a time machine to go back into October or November and get the flu shot, but nevertheless, it is still not too late to get the flu shot. Influenza is a terrible virus. It kills a lot of people, and although you might be strong enough not to kill you, you might pass it on to someone who passes it on to someone who visits his grandpa in his in the nursing home, and he gets it and goes bye-bye. So please, for God's sake, really, really think hard about getting an influenza vaccine. They're not that difficult to be gotten. They're available at pharmacies. If you have any kind of insurance coverage, they usually take it. You can ask. But please, consider taking your flu vaccine. And thank you, KD2GMB, for reminding me to remind the people of that. Hey, somehow we made it all the way to 1019, and I want to thank everyone who participated and helped me along with this. I want to remind them of things that I usually talk about, but I didn't bother to mention this week, that if you have any mailbag questions for Dick, if you have any space report-related questions for Paul, or if you have any topics or subjects, questions, puzzlers for me, you can email me at mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. And everything that I talk about for the most part is available on my link page. And there are some pictures that Paul wanted me to upload that he will be talking about during his space report. And you can go to that page at just to point your browser at roy.ac2gs.com. ggs.com, and you will land upon my link page with all kinds of interesting links. So once again, I just want to thank everyone who participated in our little get-together tonight, and hopefully Dick will be back in fine fettle next Sunday, and we'll all do it over again. So I will turn it over to Paul.
KG2RY.
David?
You know, we're bombarded with all of this information. You know, we're getting hit from all sides, you know. It could all be true, and it could all be valuable, or it could all be false and not valuable at all. And the question is, you know, how would a person know what is true and false? You know, what is people feeding us with, and why would we want to get so involved in it? Go ahead.
Because a lot of things have a eventual effect on your life. The economic bumps that are going to happen in the next few months are going to impact you. It might not be a great deal, or it might be a great deal, depending upon all the variables, but it will affect people. And as far as I'm concerned, you go with people who you respect and sound right and have consistent, well-thought-out comments and don't change things 180 degrees every 23 seconds. But that's me. And I also have honed a reasonably good Bravo Sierra meter, where I can sort of sense when someone's blowing smoke someplace. So that's me. But I think we should move on to Paul so he could do the space report.
One more thing. I just want to say, all the neat products I bought for this, you know, all the little items, the things that you couldn't buy, so, and so many different things that you can buy. Useful things were the ones that didn't cost so much. KG2RY.
Okay, David, you had your comment, and once again, let's hear it for Paul WS2N with the space report.
Very good, Roy. Thanks for all of that. Very informative. Nice. Okay, this is WS2N for the space portion of the TechNet. And I'll go through some of the topics I was on last week, but so things start to add up real quick here. Before I go on, there's one TV programming note. If you like these type of shows, they have a new Cosmos series. It's on Monday night. The first episode actually was on last Monday, but. This is the second episode. Monday nights, 9 p.m. on the National Geographic Channel. So, again, that's Neil deGrasse Tyson, and it's the third version of this. They call it the third series. I intend on watching that. So that's always pretty good. Let me just drop it for a second. Okay, now last week, it was actually last Friday, February 28th, is when this happened, down in Boca Chica, Texas. That's the location where SpaceX is building their rocket that they plan on eventually sending to Mars, called the Starship. And right now they're trying to build the second stage of it, which is really a stage that will eventually land on Mars and take off from Mars, and it's a completely reusable stage, and that will eventually be put onto a first stage, much more massive, of course, than the second stage. Second stage he's building will eventually carry like 40, 50 people. That's his ultimate goal. But he's in the process of building this, and a while back in November, he was testing it just to see if the stage could handle all the cryogenic fuels. They're using liquid methane in this case and liquid oxygen. And what happened was back in November, the top part of this, the dome part of it, like the cap on it, blew off and started all over again. and redesigned it, and they started rebuilding this whole stainless steel starship. Now, this thing is like 160 feet tall, 30 feet in diameter. And sure enough, last Friday, they were testing it again, using liquid nitrogen as a test instead of liquid methane or liquid oxygen. And they got it mostly filled up, and the whole thing just blew again. I mean, really blew. This thing took off, must have went a couple of hundred feet into the air and crashed down below. Nobody got hurt. Nobody got killed. But he's now going to redesign this, which is, I mean, I thought it was going to hold. He's got hundreds of welders welding this thing together. It's not a composite spaceship. It's all made out of stainless steel. In fact, it's 308, they call it 308 stainless, and it's 532nd of an inch thick, so 532, which is pretty thick. And for some reason, one of the welds failed near the bottom, and this thing really blew. But he's so into mass production. In fact, at one time, he's building two of these at one time, building one down in Boca Chica, Texas, where this thing blew, and another one in Florida, but he's given up the Florida one for now. He's concentrating on the one down in Texas. His ultimate goal is to build this 150-foot thing, put three Raptor engines in the bottom of it. A Raptor engine is, again, his design, talking about 3D equipment earlier. This evening, these rocket engines are mostly made out of, you know, with 3D designs. And again, it's a liquid methane, liquid oxygen engine built by SpaceX in California. And each engine will develop 440,000 pounds of thrust. So this is a massive engine. When this thing blew up, the engines were not installed. He was just testing it to see if it would hold pressure, with this cryogenically cooled nitrogen. And he didn't have a cap, or nose going on. He basically was just testing a real big tank at the time, but the whole thing blew up. So he's got to start from scratch a little bit, but because of his production, he expects to have another one ready probably within 3 or 4 weeks to test again. Let me drop it. It was at night time. It was like 11 o'clock at night. But, you know, if you go to the internet and you put in, you know, Starship explodes during test on February 28th, you can see what happened here. Pretty amazing. No fire or anything. It was just a big explosion. So, but he's pretty innovative. He's got a lot of launches under his belt. In fact, just the other day, this Friday, he launched the 20th flight to the International Space Station with cargo. SpaceX has had a contract with them since 2012, so here we are, 2020. And all these years, he's been launching up to the space station, you know, around 5,000-6,000 pounds of stuff each time. This is the 20th successful docking. Well, tomorrow they're actually going to dock. Probably, I think Tuesday they'll dock with the space station. It's in orbit right now. But it's called the CRS 20 mission. It went up. This is the 80th launch of the Falcon 9 rocket. They've been launching all these years now, 9 years with the Falcon 9 rocket. And the 50th time that they've recovered the booster after about 8 minutes after launch. Again, this was a nighttime flight. The booster came out of the sky and landed successfully back in Cape Canaveral. He's got his own landing zone there. They call it Landing Zone 1. It used to be a launch complex 13 years ago. He's taking it over. He's got a couple of launch pads there for their boosters to come back. So this is the 50th time they've returned. They've successfully returned the booster out of 80 launches. The earlier launches, he wasn't doing that. as time went on, he's pretty successful. I think the last 52 or 53 launches, he's successfully has brought back mostly all of them. So this drives the price down. Right now, it's around $62 million per flight, the way he's got it, which is like one-third of what NASA would normally use for an Atlas V rocket for a normal launch. He's become the major player for NASA and commercial companies and foreign companies putting satellites into space. And, you know, no different. He put up around 5,000 pounds of supplies going to the, right now, three-person crew that's on the International Space Station. Included in that 5,000 pounds, they sent up a new Kenwood radio for the astronauts to communicate with. It's Kenwood, TMD710, 50-watt dual-band radio. It's going to replace the one that they've been using since they went up there. I think they started Ares around 2002 or so. Ares is the amateur radio for International Space Station, where they contact all the schools. And this radio will eventually be installed in the Columbus module. And again, it's a 50-watt design. It's much more powerful than the other one. And naturally, these things do everything. You know, they'll be able to run packet off of it and everything that they normally do. That should be operational within a couple of months. Right for now, it goes into storage on the space station, and then they'll install it. And one of these radios with the head, the head will be able to be removed, and the body of it will be able to stay on one of the science racks. And they always use earphones. You can see them talking to a school, and this radio will be in the Columbus module, which is one of the ones near the front of the space station as it flies. And a couple of launches from now, they're going to launch another radio up there as well, put in the Russian segment, the Zarya segment. Russians have a half a dozen modules up there, and one of them is called the Zarya, also known as the functioning cargo block. And that was the first actual module that was actually sent up in 1999, and then we eventually sent up the Unity module with a docking unit, pressure mating adapting number one, and they eventually docked to each other. Well, that, since then they've sent up, a dozen of these modules, now a million-pound flying laboratory. And inside of the Zarya module, they have right now another transceiver up there that the Russians use for communicating with hams on the ground. And eventually they'll replace it with an identical radio that they just sent up on this cargo mission to the space station. So, naturally each module has these antennas. For instance, the Russian module has four 2-meter 5/8 whips sticking out of the module. And each one is like 90 degrees apart, so no matter which way the space station is facing, they always have continuous communications with the school if they're doing that at the time. Let me drop it. Let's see if anybody has any questions or comments for now. This is WS2N. Name here is Paul, and it's part of the TechNet. Okay, it don't have to do with this topic. It doesn't have to do, any of the space topics. We'll cover them. So another piece of equipment that they have on board is something called the Bartolomeo unit. It's located in what they call the trunk of the Dragon cargo vehicle. It's going to be docked with the space station. And eventually the robotic arm will remove it from the trunk. You won't even need astronauts. And then this Bartolomeo unit will be attached to the outside of the Columbus module. And eventually, like a porch, and they'll be able to hook up
different science experiments from either private companies or anybody that needs to run a science experiment on the outside of the space station, you know, with zero G and, you know, in a perfect vacuum. And they can run an experiment from this unit that they brought up. There is another similar thing. They call it the porch on the Japanese module. But they have one, and then European Space Agency needed one as well, so they built this thing, and now successfully launched into orbit on the way to the International Space Station. Let me drop. Now, this being CRS-20, the 20th flight, this is the end of the contract that SpaceX had with NASA for the segment of flights. Early on, they had a contract for 12 missions, and then as missions progressed, years later, they gave SpaceX another couple of billion-dollar contract for 8 more missions. But this is the last mission of the cargo version, that SpaceX had. This one had solar panels that came out. It didn't really dock with the space station autonomously. It came up very, very close to the space station. And then an astronaut would, from the cupola, from the section where you could look out of all these windows, would operate this Canadian robotic arm, this 57-foot-long arm. They call it a Canada arm, too. They would operate that arm, grab a hold of the spacecraft, and they call it berthing. It would be attached to a port on the International Space Station, either usually Unity or Harmony, but one of the two ports that are set up for this. And then it would connect to these, you know, these 5/8-inch bolts, and they would automatically be driven in, and that's how it would be attached to the space station, like a permanent module for a while, until it was not needed anymore. They would load it up with junk, disconnect it from the 16 bolts, and use the robotic arm, push it slightly away, and then the spacecraft would ignite its engines and eventually find its way to the South Pacific Ocean and burn up in the atmosphere. Let me drop it. That's the normal way for cargo vehicles to be destroyed. SpaceX was a little different, a lot different actually. They, instead of burning up over the Pacific Ocean, they would fly it a couple of hundred miles away from the southern part of California, and it would come through with a heat shield, parachutes, and it would land in the Pacific Ocean. And SpaceX had their own boat there. They didn't need NASA. They had their own ship that would pick up the Dragon, and they would bring it to shore, and they'd be able to bring all the science equipment and everything back out. And the scientists like that, of course, and they'd get their information very quick that way. They didn't have to wait. Now what they're going to do is that version is done. It's done. SpaceX now has a new, not only a crew version, but also a new cargo version that will go up probably later on this year, probably around November or December. Although the crew version might go up a little bit before that, but this cargo version does not have inside the cargo area. They don't have the Super Draco engines or the fuel or anything that the crew version would have. You would need a lot of room for that. And what that does, the Super Draco engines, it's for an emergency, for an abort, they would fire and pull the vehicle away from the booster when they were going uphill. Since the crew cargo version doesn't need that, they don't need all those engines, they don't need the fuel, they don't need the life support, although they do have some, a small amount of life support inside. they also don't need the big long solar panels that unfold on every one of these missions that they've flown. They're still going to have solar panels, but they're going to be attached to the body of the spacecraft. So if you ever see, you know, watch the launch, you know, they take off, the first booster comes back, you know, the main booster comes back and lands on land, or lands on a ship out in the Atlantic Ocean, and you eventually see the second stage with the one Merlin engine light up, and eventually that goes off, and then that separates from the Dragon cargo vehicle, and the last thing you always see is the solar panels opening up, and then they're pretty big. I mean, they're about, you know, 60 feet long from one end to the other. That's all being done away with. Solar panels are just tight to the body of the spacecraft itself. And they're building it's almost a duplicate of the crew version. Now, the crew version is going to be the same as the cargo version in the docking process to the space station. No longer will this cargo vehicle that will be going up later this year to the space station, no longer will they need to have a robotic arm come out and reach and grab a hold of it, attach it to a Harmony module. This thing will be autonomous. It will come in and it will guide itself and dock with the pressure mating adapter, either number two or number three. And you have these pressure mating adapters attached to the space station and different locations on the space station. And they'll come in and dock up with the ITER. The ITER is the international docking adapter that NASA put up there a few years ago that astronauts attach to the pressure mating adapter. So this way it will match any vehicle that's coming up. So it will be able to dock with the space station autonomously. Just dock, they'll be able to come through, the crew will be able to come through, open up the doors, all the hatches will be open, and they'll be able to get all their supplies through that opening. So no longer will they have the capability, though, of bringing large things through. When you attach in a berth method, the oldest system with all these bolts, you have a 52-inch, basically a 52-inch opening to bring equipment, large items through the door. On the autonomous docking system, you're only down to about a meter, a little bit bigger than a meter. So, 40-inch opening instead of the 52, 53-inch opening. So what they can bring through will be a little on the smaller side. NASA doesn't mind, that's fine. I mean, there's plenty of stuff that comes into the space station itself. They don't need to have that big. But NASA will still have three other vehicles that will be able to berth with the space station, so they don't have to worry. They'll have the Cygnus spacecraft, which is still making their flights from Virginia, from Wallops Island, Virginia. That's Northrop Grumman that launches the Antares rocket with Cygnus on top. That's a cargo vehicle, so they'll be able to bring any large items up that they need for that. And there's two other vehicles like that as well. Right now there's the HTV by Japan, which brings up a tremendous amount of cargo, I think around 12,000 pounds, twice the amount that SpaceX could bring up. And that's also berths with the station. They need the robotic arm for that as well. And that usually goes up around once a year. And then there's another one that's being built presently, and it hasn't gone up there yet. And that's being built by Sierra Nevada Corporation, SNC, is building Dream Chaser, and that's the one with the wings, and it's going to land on a runway. It kind of looks like a small shuttle, and that will have the capability of doing both, actually berthing with the space station for larger items or docking similar to what I described before. So that's what's going on. Hopefully, we'll see a manned launch this year. My guess is that we will with Dragon, and that will be a crew vehicle similar to what I just described. They'll dock autonomously with the space station, bring a crew of most likely two guys on the first mission, and as time goes on, they'll bring up four at a time as they know the spacecraft is safe to fly on a regular basis. So they'll have four people coming up every time they go up, which will allow a crew of seven on a permanent basis instead of a crew of six. So that's what's going on with SpaceX and their rockets. Hopefully Starship gets going once, that's the one that exploded with the liquid nitrogen. Hopefully that gets going soon, because he's had a few problems with that. The first test of that will probably be maybe within a couple of months, once he gets the next one built, as long as the tanks hold. He plans on attaching three of these Raptor engines. The goal is to eventually have six, but for now he wants to attach three, and he wants to launch this thing around 12 miles into off the ground, which is over twice the amount that an airplane would fly. If he could, he'd like to get that high, but he'd be happy with 12 miles high. And if he gets that, the idea of it will be to have that Starship come back down and land where it took off from back at, in this case, it would be coming back to Cape Kennedy on landing zone one, land vertically. And then once he could do that and do that on a regular basis, he plans on eventually maybe sending one of these things, even so the second stage, to orbit, just to orbit and have it come back. And that will be an achievement. No vehicle has ever done that from any country or any company, where you can take one vehicle, launch it off the ground, and put it into orbit, and then have it come back. And, it's a 160-foot thing. But eventually he plans on putting this 160-foot second stage on top of a booster that he plans on building, same diameter, 30 feet, and having this booster launch this spacecraft that already would have the capability of making it to orbit. Now that thing would be up there completely fueled. It would be able to have the capability of going to the moon, or maybe even refueling again, maybe going off to Mars. I mean, that's his ultimate goal. And this booster piece that would go up, which is like 260 feet tall itself, not 160 feet, but 260 feet tall, would actually come back and land also back at Cape Canaveral. So not only the second stage is going to be completely 100% reusable, the first stage itself will also become 100% reusable. So, I mean, that's Elon Musk's goal. He's getting older, but he's in a mad rush. He's hiring people left and right down in Boca Chica, Texas, to try to weld these things together. He's got the ultimate plan of building, like, one of these every, like, couple of weeks. I mean, he's way out there. I know he says things and then he falls short of some of his predictions. But some of his predictions come true. Sometimes it's years later, but who knows? We might see a different world from now in the future. Any questions or comments for this portion of the TechNet? This is WS2N, and I have an ID, and I don't remember when. This is WS2N. Okay, very good. There was a launch I wanted to talk about that was going to occur last week, but it was scrubbed, and it fortunately it hasn't been rescheduled. Now, we're going from the very large rocket, this, you know, rocket that was as big as the Saturn V, this Starship I was just talking about with its booster, to the very small. This rocket is only 38 feet tall. It's made by a company called Astra, A-S-T-R-A. It had a planned launch from, they were going to launch from Kodiak, Alaska, the Pacific Spaceport, now they call it. And it was supposed to go up last week. And the idea was to have a spacecraft, you know, that's small, maybe, you know, 100 pounds, and have that be able to be put into orbit by a small rocket. So this company, Astra, wanted to do it. And DARPA, that's, you know, part of the government, the defense agency, wanted to have, you know, somebody do this. So years ago, they made a challenge, and they said any company that could do this, just launch within a couple of days' notice, put a 100-pound satellite into orbit, we'll give you $2 million. And then if you could launch from another launch pad, even another launch complex in a different part of the world, within 10 days, we'll not only give you the $2 million, we'll give you $10 million. So a couple of companies got involved with it, and Astra was the only one that stayed with it. And but they had a time frame, and they could only go to the date, that, to the last date that they had to launch. They scrubbed a couple of times because of bad weather, and they got to the last 53 seconds, and it was the last day of this challenge, and if they didn't make it, they weren't going to get their $2 million. 53 seconds, and sure enough, they scrubbed it. The navigation and control, GNC, called a no-go. And that was the end of that $2 million. So apparently they have a problem they need to address. They never rescheduled, but I'm sure they will, because they're gung-ho. They have, you know, they built these Dolphin engines, 3D produced engines, and up to launch a 38-foot rocket into orbit. That I wanted to see, but it didn't come off. I mean, it's so small that to ship it to Alaska, it's manufactured in California. They could fit it inside the back of a tractor trailer truck. They put it in there and they brought it to Alaska. Presently, they're making plans on building a launch complex in the Kwajalein Islands. That's down in the Pacific. And in fact, that's where SpaceX started out. They had the Falcon 1 instead of the Falcon 9. They had the Falcon 1, and they launched a series of rockets, and they finally made it to orbit in Kwajalein. And because they were successful, they got a contract with NASA, and now they're a multi-billion dollar company that they are today. But this company, Astra, is going to try to do the same thing. They're going to also set up a launch complex in Kwajalein Islands. It's, you know, right on the equator almost of the Earth, where they could take advantage of the 1,000 mile per hour advantage that you get by launching from the equator, as opposed to the northern latitude near where they're launching in Kodiak, Alaska. But, you know, what happened was they're going to make a comeback. So we're going to have all kinds of companies in the near future. Firefly is another small launch complex, launch company, a lot bigger than Astra, but that's going to be another one. And a couple of the other ones, a lot of people are competing for that. There's one that's already doing it on a regular basis. They've already launched like 11 rockets in space, and that's Rocket Lab, and they're doing that down in New Zealand. But they just finished a launch complex in Virginia in the United States, and they plan on launching from Virginia very shortly. So it's another one that launches relatively small vehicles. One last thing I wanted to get to. I sent three pictures over to Roy's website, roy.ac2gs, and these three pictures have to do with the first successful docking of two vehicles in geosynchronous orbit. Let me drop it. The one, there's one vehicle up there, one satellite, communication satellite, by IntelSat. IntelSat has dozens of satellites in geosynchronous orbit, which is 23,000 miles out, you know, from the surface of the Earth. And one of their satellites, called 901, IntelSat 901, is pretty much ran out of fuel. It was launched back in 2001, so here it is all these years later, almost 20 years later, and it's still operating, but, you know, running out of fuel. And it's, you know, a good communication satellite. It costs these people billions of dollars to put these satellites into space. This thing's a 10,000-pound satellite. Well, ran out of fuel, what do we do? And sure enough, here comes Northrop Grumman with this design of a service satellite. And they call it MEV-1, MEV, Mission Extension Vehicle, number one. First time they ever launched anything like this. So they launched it from, got launched from the Soviet Union, from, Russia. It took a couple of months to get to geosynchronous orbit. And, you know, the reason for that is, you know, it was a second satellite on that rocket. It wasn't the main satellite, but eventually it got to where it had to go. It has these ion engines, two of them, which eventually got it to a geosynchronous orbit, and it got up to where IntelSat 901, the one that's running out of fuel, was sitting, and it got behind it. It started taking pictures of it. It's got radar, LIDAR, and all kinds of, you know, high-tech stuff on it to guide itself into a close vicinity. And they went to different locations, and eventually they got right next to it. It's got this probe, and it got behind a satellite. And right where the nozzle is, you know, the exhaust for the main thruster on the failed satellite, that it entered the probe into this nozzle. And after it got inside, opens up, you know, similar to a toggle bolt that you would use on a wall, you know, a pipe that would pop open after you put it through the wall, and you could tighten something up, that type of deal. It did that, and it pulled itself in, and it became one. I mean, it's just one big satellite now. MEV-1 is attached to it. It's got plenty of fuel. It's now able to move the satellite to actually a better location where IntelSat wanted it. It's going to take a month or so to get there, but, you know, it's got these ion rockets. Those things are just ion thrusters. Those things, they can move it into a location and leave it there. And so now it's like a refuel satellite. It was on its way out. It had almost 20 years. Now it's going to get another 5 years. This thing's going to stay attached for 5 years. You know, MEV-1 is now a success. First time it was ever done. And now, in 5 years from now, MEV-1 is going to disconnect itself. Well, it's going to first bring the satellite to the graveyard. They call it the graveyard, where it won't interfere with any other satellites. It'll disconnect itself from 901, and it's going to fly to another satellite that's failing. And it could do this, you know, two more times. The lifespan for MEV-1 is 15 years, so it's going to save another satellite. Northrop Grumman has another MEV, they call it MEV-2, Mission Extension Vehicle. Number two being built that they'll eventually send up, and there's another one behind that. So it's very inexpensive to send these things up, but you know, you don't have to have, you know, this billion-dollar satellite with all kinds of transponders and everything that these communication satellites and geosynchronous orbit have. But all you need is a satellite with fuel in it and guidance, and you know, a way to attach to it. And now, because of that, NASA is now giving Northrop Grumman another contract to actually develop another similar type of MEV vehicle, but with robotic arms on it. And eventually, it might be able to service another satellite in orbit or refuel a satellite in orbit. That would be the next step. But for now, this is a perfect situation for a company that needs to extend the life on their geosynchronous satellites. Let me just drop it, see if anybody has any questions or comments. Usually we end the net at this time, so let me drop it. This is WS2N for the space portion of the TechNet. Okay, nothing. We have plenty of other topics to cover, but we'll just add that to next week. And nobody has any comments or questions, we'll close the net for tonight. Let's see, tomorrow's the ClubNet, Club Info Net, and that's always on these repeaters not at 8 o'clock like this net. It'll be 8:30. So we'll check into that. Anybody have any comments? If not, I'm going to turn it back to Roy. And Roy, you had great topics tonight. And I'm sure we're going to revisit the coronavirus again every week for a while. I hope that story has to eventually go away, but for now, I think it's going to be number one on the runway. Back to you, Roy. AC2GS, this is WS2N.
Thank you very much, Paul. Yes, unfortunately, I don't want my segment to kind of degenerate into medical talk with Dr. Roy, but I think it's warranted, especially because of the degree of misinformation that's scattered about and that we hear all over the place. So kind of hearing one point of view, hopefully an informed one, will be helpful. Of course, if no one really is interested anymore, then there'll be no participation, and I'll get the message and eventually wander off to a different subject. But unfortunately, I think, as I keep on saying, it's going to get unfortunately worse before it gets better. And it might get better relatively soon, but it is going to get worse before it gets better. So I just want to thank everyone who participated tonight, who made this an interesting experience, an opportunity to exchange ideas and opinions and what have you. So thanks to everyone who participated. Thanks for those who listened. Thanks for those who sat there and waited for me to be over so that they could hear Paul. As always, if you have any technical questions or mailbag questions for Dick that you would like to have me pass along, because you can't go on to the technical net, or if you have anything you want me to pass on to Paul for the space report, or if you have any questions or topics or puzzlers for me, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. And the link page where you'll be able to see Paul's images is roy.ac2gs.com. And as always, we have a shortcut for our little chat room. That's chat.ac2gs.com. And if anyone needs an audio feed because Echo Link is down or erratic or what have you, you can always point your browser at technet.ac2gs.com, and that will give you an audio stream of the technical net. So once again, I want to thank everyone who participated. I certainly want to thank Paul for all that he has done, and thank Dick for all he's done all these many, many years. And hopefully all three of us will be back here next Sunday at 8 o'clock to do it all over again. So this is Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra Roy here, and be safe, and we'll talk to you again. This is AC2GS, and I'll be clear. Thank you.